This is an ABC podcast.
G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. This is Tom Switzer. Always great to have your company. Well, this week we've been told the impact of human-induced global warming is worse than previously feared. We have 12 years to limit climate change catastrophe. To avoid drought, floods, poverty, and extreme heat, the global economy must be transformed immediately. Among other things, coal-generated electricity must be phased out globally by 2050. Now, that's the judgment of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So, is the goal of drastically slashing emissions to reduce global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, is that goal economically and practically possible? And if not, what should we do? Well, we have two views on this subject. David Karoly is Professor of Atmospheric Science at the University of Melbourne. We'll hear from him later in the program. But first, Richard Lindzen. He was Professor of Meteorology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the author of more than 200 peer-reviewed papers on climatology and meteorology, and he's a member of the US National Academy of Sciences. This week, he delivered the 2018 annual Global Warming Policy Foundation address in London. First, your response to the latest IPCC report.
First of all, as usual, when I hear the news release, I want to look at the report. I haven't really looked at it yet, but my experience with the IPCC, people don't realize you have three working groups. One is the science, another is mitigation, another is impacts. And the working group one usually is, you know, fairly cautious. I wouldn't say unbiased, but I've rarely seen them denying things like there's no increase in extreme events that they acknowledge freely. On the other hand, one of the sources of bias in Working Group 1 is they have to continue to allow for the possibility that it might be very dangerous. For instance, find the 2014 brought down the lower limit of expected warming and then added the bizarre statement that they have no basis for choosing one value rather than another, which is really a response to the fact that all the evidence is they've overestimated things.
But the IPCC, though, claims that most of the warming over the past 60 years is due to man's activities. And there has been sea level rises, correct?
Of course there has, for hundreds of years. There's no sign of acceleration.
So your line then is that although there's been a change in global mean temperature, it's much smaller than what the IPCC computer models have predicted.
Oh, sure. In fact, we've had almost 20 years of no change at all, at least at the level of statistical significance.
We often hear that 97% of scientists agree that human-induced warming will lead to climate disaster. You're one of the leading climate scientists. Do you feel isolated here?
No. You know, in other words, 97% don't agree with that statement. The studies have all been bogus. If you want 100% agreement or almost 100% agreement, you could argue that it has warmed since the Little Ice Age, which is a welcome thing, and that man has contributed something to it. I mean, at some level, as Ed Lorenz pointed out, the fluttering of a bird's wings will have some impact, so why not man?
The IPCC authors and many people referring to their work say that global warming should make those recent hurricanes that we witnessed in southeast of the United States wetter, slower, and more intense. And if we fail to decarbonize the economy, these kinds of devastating weather events will likely become even more frequent and more severe. Your response?
Well, you know, we've had the lowest number of hurricanes in generations in the last 10, 11 years. These hurricanes were not remarkably strong. Every hurricane has its own feature. But, you know, when I was a kid, well, before I was born, 1938 was the biggest hurricane New England ever had. Utterly devastating, hundreds of dead. The Galveston 1905 storm was much bigger than anything we've had. So, you know, these are just scare tactics. The projections as to what will happen, you know, by the time you get to forecasts that are poor and base policy on them, you have to examine your own motives.
Will the IPCC findings put pressure on governments around the world to prioritize efforts to decarbonize their economies?
I think you can see the answer is no. And you can see that from the news coverage here in Europe and in the U.S. The first day the report came out, it got headline coverage, right? By that very evening, it had disappeared from the news cycle. There are predictions that are so silly that even the media, I think, at some point begins to realize you don't push it. And maybe even politicians will realize that.
What about the Paris Climate Accords in 2015? We're all too often told that this was a landmark in reducing emissions.
Well, I mean, you know, it promised to do nothing except exchange money between some countries and other countries. Nobody really was obligated to do anything by the Paris Accord.
Well, that's a fair point. I mean, unlike Kyoto, it's not legally binding and enforceable and verifiable. But
No. Nevertheless,
you've still got the European Union, Richard. They are promising to cut emissions by 2050 by 80%. Is Brussels a role model here for other developed states such as Australia?
No, and it's not even a model for the European states who are all backing off of their commitments.
It's an interesting point because the prevailing wisdom in policymaking circles in Canberra is that Australia is well behind the rest of the world when it comes to decarbonising the economy.
Look, you know the country that has had the greatest reduction in emissions.
What country is that?
The US.
And that's not because of carbon regulations, is it?
No, it's because natural gas turned out to be, you know, popular compared to coal.
What about this global climate fund that is part of the Paris Climate Accords? I mean, this is the global fund, for those of you not familiar, through which rich nations foot the bill for climate mitigation in the developing world. Industrialized countries said at Paris they'll provide something like $100 billion a year, US, from 2020 onwards.
I heard $200 billion.
$200 billion, okay. Well, $200 or $100 billion. What do you make of that UN Global Fund that we often hear about?
Well, you remember the definition of foreign aid, which was taking money from the poor in rich countries and giving it to the rich in poor countries. Given the level of corruption in these countries, it's a bribe for them to go along with a political process. And I don't think anyone is taking it terribly seriously. And the countries that are supposed to receive the money are complaining bitterly that it's not coming in fast enough.
Yes, but your critics would say that China is making great efforts to green its economy with emissions trading schemes. Is it true that China is decarbonizing its economy, Richard?
No, of course not. They're building more coal-fired plants than the rest of the world by a large margin. I think they're very cynical. I think they know that the world is engaged in the pathological exercise and they might as well take advantage of it.
What about emissions? Are emissions coming down in China as a result of the Paris Climate Change Accords?
No evidence of that whatever, nor should there be. I mean, there's no evidence that the emissions have gone down any place.
What about India?
The US.
What about India?
No. And, you know, they're open about it. I don't think they plan to make any reductions for the foreseeable future. Now, look, these countries have an obligation to their citizens, and it's not to screw them.
Nigel Lawson has been our guest on this program. He says that leaders in many of these developing countries want to grow their economies and reduce poverty, and the cheapest way of doing that for the foreseeable future is on the back of carbon energy. Something like 60% of emissions in the world come from non-OECD countries. If they're not decarbonising their economies, how then can we meet this goal of reducing carbon emissions dramatically, or global temperatures down to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels?
Well, you're saying a lot of things at once. You know, first of all, why 1.5 rather than 2? 2 is a political number. 1.5 is a political number. They see that the temperatures are not going up. So they're saying we better lower the number for a scare tactic. This has nothing to do with science. Now, the question is, what does it have to do with? And people have been very open-minded about it. You know, it has to do with global governance and why that should be a great concern of individual countries. I can understand it, but I don't know why they'd go along with it.
If the economic and political costs of climate change are too high, as you say, what then? How should we deal with the threat of human-induced global warming?
First, you have to establish you have anything you're dealing with. Remember, you're measuring the temperature, global mean temperature anomaly, since the end of the Little Ice Age, an anomalously cold period. You have barely any instrumental record of it. You're talking about really small changes. The only thing the temperature record tells you is it's small. And you have people obsessing over temperature changes that are small compared to what they see every day. And I don't know what to make of this. But all your questions are predicated on the reality of this, and I don't think that's a correct assumption.
Richard, thanks so much for being on the program.
Okay, good luck.
That was Professor Richard Lindzen. He's from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's the author of more than 200 peer-reviewed papers on climatology and meteorology, and he's a member of the US National Academy of Sciences. Now for a different view, let's hear from David Karoly. He's the leader of the Earth Systems and Climate Change Hub in the Australian Government's National Environmental Science Program. It's based in CSIRO. He's also an honorary professor in the School of Earth Sciences at the University of Melbourne and a member of the National Climate Science Advisory Committee. Now, I've just been chatting with Professor Richard Lindzen, pioneering climate scientist with decades at Harvard and MIT. In response to IPCC reports generally, David, he says there's more or less been a hiatus in warming that has now lasted for about 20 years and which the climate models fail to predict, even as global carbon dioxide emissions have climbed dramatically. Your response?
Well, that's wrong. Everything he said there is wrong.
Now, he says that over the past 20 years, humans have emitted record levels of carbon dioxide year after year, but the warming trend of previous decades has stopped. And yep. He says that's consistent with what he holds responsible for climate change, some human-induced impact, and a whole lot of natural variability.
Sure, but let me try to tell you what has actually happened in terms of global average temperature. Most people, when they look at the global average temperature data since 1880 right up till 2017, the last full year that we've got data, will see that 2015 was hotter than any other previous year. Then 2016 was the hottest year in all the 100 years. And then 2017, while not quite as hot as 2016, was substantially hotter than any other year in the last 100 years. It's very hard to see a hiatus or slowdown in the rate of warming when we are setting new records in 2015.
Yeah, but you yourself have argued in the past that from 98 to about 2012, there's been a reduction in the warming trend in global average temperature due to natural variability, correct?
Correct. And yes, we do expect within the global temperature record periods of faster rates of warming and also slower rates of warming. And it's important to look at the long-term record as well as the recent record. And Richard Lindzen is quite correct that there is decadal variability in the temperature record, but not that there's been no warming at all. And in fact, the rate of warming over the last 10 years is higher than the rate of warming over the previous 10 years. So there are natural variability associated with interactions between the ocean and the atmosphere. And when we look over the long-term record, or even over the last 20 or 30 years, we see a continuing rate of warming.
Hasn't the IPCC previously found that most climate models, not all, but most, had overestimated the rate of global warming since the 1990s?
No, that's not the case. First of all, the IPCC has not completed an assessment of all the climate model simulations, because those ones that had been done were only simulated in what's called the coupled model intercomparison project. When we look at the climate model simulations up until 2017, the most recent period, most models actually lie well within the range of natural variability and show much the same rate of warming over the period since 1990 right up until 2017 as has been found in the observation.
Hasn't the IPCC conceded, though, in recent times that it has, quote, low confidence that there has been measurable uptick in storm intensity thanks to human activity?
Well, that's a very different question. So if you're talking about now the changes in storm systems, then in terms of measurable changes in storm systems, and it depends exactly whether you're talking about tropical cyclones or in terms of other sorts of weather systems like low-pressure systems that bring rainfall to many of the mid-latitude systems, for tropical cyclones and hurricanes, there is relatively low confidence in many of the aspects of long-term changes in tropical cyclones. They are an important component of the climate system. Mm. But you're correct. The IPCC has said there is low confidence in an increasing trend in the global number of tropical cyclones or hurricanes. And so, yes, there are many aspects of the small-scale variations of the climate system, particularly associated with thunderstorms or with tropical cyclones, which are not well represented. And in fact, one of the conclusions from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change analysis is that the expectation is a reduction in the number of tropical cyclones, but an expected increase in the intensity of those systems. And yes, the confidence in that assessed by the IPCC is low confidence.
Now, Professor Lindzen, and he's not alone here, that Judith Curry from the Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech, William Happer, a professor of physics at Princeton, they say that this IPCC report significantly underestimates the costs of slashing carbon emissions. Their argument is that decarbonising the global economy, it's not a cost-free exercise, that fossil fuels, for the time being at least, provide cheap, efficient power, whereas green energy remains mostly uncompetitive. How would you respond to those concerns?
Well, I'm not an economist, and so I generally tend to provide comment on the areas in which I have expertise. As far as I'm aware, neither Richard Lindzen, nor Judith Curry, nor William Happer are economists. My advice to them would be to stick to their areas.
It's not just these climate scientists who are making this point. It's other economists and columnists. They'll say that the costs of decarbonising the economy are so high that this will ultimately mean that poor nations, developing nations, fewer people will be lifted out of poverty, that for rich nations, the most vulnerable will be hit by higher power bills. So I suppose the question here is, can the Paris Climate Accords, do they really represent a landmark decision when you've got governments in these countries that are reluctant to slash emissions?
First of all, my understanding is that in the Paris commitment and in the most recent IPCC assessment, the conclusions are that strong emission reductions are needed to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees, or to seek to limit it to 1.5 degrees, and that the assessments by the governments and the conclusions is that the IPCC report has been accepted by all governments, including the US government and the Australian government, and they accept the conclusions of the IPCC report in terms of the relative costs of electricity generation from renewable energy sources as being an opportunity to build new industries in many different countries, and that it is feasible, but there will be some cost associated with transitioning to a zero carbon electricity generation system.
But I mean, Kyoto was legally binding. It didn't include the developing countries. Paris is not legally binding. It's not verifiable and it's not enforceable. That's why many leading climate activists, they slammed Paris as ineffective 3 years ago. How can these governments be serious about slashing emissions when it's not even binding?
Well, I think you'll find that there was no binding role in the Kyoto Protocol. So if you're comparing Kyoto versus the Paris commitments, the same level of legal obligations for meeting the agreements under the Paris commitment apply as applied to the Kyoto. There was no penalties imposed for any country that did not meet its commitments.
David, why are US carbon emissions coming down?
The US carbon emissions are coming down because of a range of initiatives that were taken under the past agreements within the EPA in the United States, as well as the
ones that Trump wants to get rid of.
Again, yep. I'm not a political expert.
Professor Lindzen says it's the shale fracking boom in natural gas, and he says that's driving the reduction in US carbon emissions. It's also, by the way, the biggest market challenge to coal power.
So there's a range of reasons, increases in fracking in the United States and increases in natural gas are important, but there has also been a very major increase in wind power and solar power generation in the United States, which has provided substantial opportunities for reductions in the need for fossil fuel generated electricity.
Yeah,
so they're all important.
Yeah. Let's turn to the developing world. The non-OECD nations account for something like 60% of global emissions. According to Lindzen and others like him, they're producing more coal and building more coal-fired power stations than ever. Will China, the world's number one emitter, sacrifice economic growth for reducing carbon emissions?
Again, as I said before, I'm not an economist, nor am I an energy expert. I'm a climate scientist, and I can talk to you about climate science, but I can't talk to you about what China is planning to do. Again, as I said before, I tend to stick to commentary on areas for which I have expertise. And if Richard Lindzen or Judith Curry or others, William Happer, wish to comment about areas in which they have no expertise but still want to comment, that's up to them.
Yeah, I know. But the New York Times in 2017, they said that these China's energy companies will make up nearly half of the new coal generation expected to go online in the next decade. This is what the New York Times said. These Chinese companies are building or planning to build more than 700 new coal plants at home and around the world, some in countries that today burn little or no coal. And the new plants would expand the world's coal-fired power capacity by 43%. That's the New York Times. Now, I know you don't want to get involved in the economics of all this, but to the extent that those trends continue, why on earth would China's leaders and India's leaders slash emissions when their goal is to reduce poverty and grow their economies?
In both China and India, the emissions per person associated with fossil fuel generated electricity is substantially lower than in the United States or in Australia. So if you're trying to distribute a limited resource, in this case, the limited resource is the allowance for emissions of fossil fuels into the atmosphere, the most appropriate way to distribute a limited resource, whether it's a birthday party at your five-year-old child or grandchild's birthday party, the most fair way to do it, distributing a finite resource, is to give the same amount per person. So when we think about the same amount per person, both Australia and the United States have much higher per person emissions of a finite resource if we wish to limit global warming to under 2 degrees, preferably to limit it to 1.5 degrees. We have to think about, well, what is a fair allocation of that to individuals in the United States or Australia or in China or India? And the answer to that is, the fair amount would be to give everyone the same sort of allocation, and that means that Australia and the United States need to dramatically reduce their emissions so that their per person allocation is much the same as in China and no higher than the global average.
But you hear the messages from Canberra and certainly from many countries around the world. What happens when these governments around the world fail to heed the IPCC message? I mean, haven't we heard these dire warnings time and again? I go back to October 2009, the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown warned of global warming catastrophe. He said, we had only 50 days to save the world. This, of course, was before the Copenhagen summit in 2009. Tim Flannery had said things like, even the rain that falls isn't going to fill our dams and our river systems. Is there a danger that some of the consensus scientists and commentators are overstating their case here, David?
Well, first of all, neither Gordon Brown nor Tim Flannery were involved in the IPCC assessments. So again, we need to think about, well, who were the people involved in the IPCC assessments? There have been major impacts associated with the increases in global average temperature over the last 100 years, leading to major weather-related extremes and leading to significant impacts, increases in hot extremes, increases in sea level rise leading to erosion in coastal areas, changes in rainfall patterns. All of these have been clearly linked in some locations to the impacts associated with increasing global average temperatures. This hasn't been a catastrophe as yet, but certainly if your house has been caught up in a bushfire that's been linked to increasing greenhouse gases, or a number of people have lost their lives associated with heat stress associated with heat waves, those have been clearly linked and those are disastrous for the individuals involved.
David, thanks so much for being on Between the Lines today.
I'm very happy to be involved.
David Crowley, an honorary professor in the School of Earth Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He's also the leader of the Earth Systems and Climate Change Hub in the Australian Government's National Environmental Science Program. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Always great to have your company. Remember, if you've missed past episodes of the program, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Between the Lines. Let's chat next week.